and welcome to the Inside Betting Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Trenhale. So, episode 8 seems like a good thing, but I have to say that so far, episode 8 has been a bit of a good things, bad things scenario. Good thing, managed to put a nice little piece of music and record a separate introduction, so I don't have to say, welcome to the Inside Betting Podcast, my name is Matthew Trenhale, over and over again. Bad things, I recorded an hour's worth of audio on betting exchanges and lost it. Don't know why it hasn't been recorded properly or saved properly. There you go. From what I understand, this happens to absolutely everyone at some point who does podcasts. I'm trying not to let it make me crawl into a ball and cry, but it definitely was frustrating. So this is the second attempt at recording this episode, and I hope that it will surpass the lost first attempt. So admin out of the way first, still not on iTunes, still sending emails daily, it seems, to Anchor to try and chivvy them along to help with it. They say it's with iTunes. They're not being very helpful. But, you know, there we go. Please do use Anchor if you can. I don't think it's that bad an app, really, especially if you actually want to start recording your own stuff, or indeed SoundCloud or one of the other places where they have actually managed to get it up on. And I appreciate your commitment, even if your preferred medium is Apple Podcasts. I'm now getting close to the end of the questions that came out of my initial request for possible article ideas when I was writing on Medium, and now obviously I've committed more to the podcast, so more to talking about subjects. So please, please do send in new ideas, new requests. My fallback plan, if there are not sufficient requests, would be to try and do something weekly on a given sport, probably golf, I guess, being the area I know most about. Or alternatively, trying to chat to certain people. I'd love it if anyone asks if they could be on my podcast. That'd be great. Or potentially host something with someone. But the questions I have left, there was some very general just suggestions on the kind of things that people would like to hear about. So just so people don't feel like I've forgotten them, at Amazing Amira, what do you know about people or things that isn't generally known or that goes against conventional wisdom? As a rule, that is an excellent thing to write about. I hope, where possible, I am talking about things that are not generally known about people outside of the betting world too much, or people who are not working within the industry, etc. And I hope that some of it goes against conventional wisdom. At Nick's Pick said he's always interested in content regarding the day-to-day goings-ons of in-house trading apartments, the way they compile their odds, how it's changed over the years, impact of machines, and of highly skilled traders leaving their roles. Certainly some of the highly skilled traders left their roles. So yeah, that again, I'm more than happy to talk about all of that stuff. Some more focused questions, if anyone has anything out about how bookmakers trade or trading in general, I can target, because I say that's a pretty, what Brian's asked me there is basically me to talk about everything I've learned over 17 years or so. So if we can dial it in just a little bit more narrow focus, that would be great. But definitely all those things I'd like to talk about. Recently at Lucky A Day, who I've already answered a question of previously, had another good question regarding if I had views on how closing prices deviate from what the efficient prices would be. So the most predictive prices, or rather how efficient the closing prices are. That is an episode by itself, opening versus closing prices and their efficiency and accuracy. Definitely one I'm going to do, so I can bookmark that. But the question I'm going to answer today is by @BookiesIndex. who asks whether Betfair can retain its position as number one betting exchange, specifically with new players undercutting it. And that alludes very much to the reduced commission they charge compared to Betfair. So I'm probably going to flesh this out a bit further just to talk about betting exchanges in general, which hopefully people will find useful. From an overall point of view, we can break it down into what a betting exchange provider needs and what a betting exchange user needs. And they both need liquidity, and so they both are completely intertwined with each other. Because both in an exchange, the exchange has to do its best to ensure that liquidity is provided one way or the other, and the user is stuck without it. Now, there are a wide range of ways that you can do the betting exchange can provide liquidity. And in an ideal world, it would do it purely by organic growth. So they would attract as many customers as they could, a whole variety, you know, it doesn't really matter whether they're independent syndicates, companies, you name it, and needs them to turn over as much money as possible, generate as much commission for the exchange as possible. In order to do that, you need someone who has not only interest in that model, faith in that model as a business. I'll get to assess the four major betting exchanges in a minute, who all have varying degrees of intellectual appetite for betting exchanges and so on. But I would definitely think that any sports betting exchange, in order to succeed, needs someone who is passionate about it, or at least, maybe if not passionate about the method, is passionate about what they think the returns could be from doing it well. They need a lot of high-powered infrastructure. They need, you know, things such as very powerful internet connections and computer servers. And they also need infrastructure in terms of staff to create markets, settle markets, time delays, markets, halting, you know, pausing action when goals go in, these kind of things. So they're pretty resource intensive. So they need someone who understands that you need a certain amount of startup capital and infrastructure to get them going. And that you should then be able to, once you've outlaid quite a lot of money on these things, then hopefully reap the dividend of ever increasing volumes for your exchange. And with everything already in place, it should be, you know, you should see a greater margin as less and less is going into costs, initial startup costs, that kind of thing. And from the user perspective, what does the betting exchange user need? They need to have a reason to use the exchange. And that can be a variety of users. One of the most underrated reasons, unfortunately, is because it's enjoyable. Why should someone who wants to have a bet use a betting exchange as opposed to their bookmaker? There's plenty of reasons people use exchanges along the lines of they use it for arbitrage, possibly, or because they're banned from bookmakers or can't get the sufficient size bet on. But what really we need is betting exchange users who like the idea of trading, like the idea of using the exchange, and want to actively participate in it. Even better if we can attract people, users, who like the concept, or I remember the old Betfair tagline of "you can be the bookie," you know, who like the idea of making a market, putting up money on the exchange, or even better, putting up money on the exchange for several different outcomes simultaneously. Betting exchanges don't have to have those kind of clients, but I think they do need them if they can get them. Easier said than done. So ideally we have betting exchange users who need to do that, who need to feel the need to, you know, enjoy the intellectual challenge of doing things that way. But other than that, you know, things like stability, you know, consistency of liquidity, generally, I suppose, a bit of innovation here or there, you know, offering new markets and so on. Again, they'll only really catch fire if people provide liquidity for them. It's possible that, you know, there will be users who need to be able to market make a certain market, and the exchange allow, you know, facilitates that. That's brilliant. But yes, no, in general, you know, betting exchanges, they need turnover, and users need liquidity, which also equates to turnover. So, you know, the betting exchange model, in theory, is symbiotic, much in the same way, I suppose. You know, I mean, bookmaker and punter, you know, they both need each other, but they both want different things. But in theory, you know, your exchange is working with you to facilitate your needs as much as possible, and wants you to be successful so that it can be successful. So who are going to be the main participants within this? They're going to be market makers, punters, traders, and then the group that does fall into the people above to a degree, but also those who are primarily dedicated towards match betting and arbitrage. So market makers can be, for me, a market maker is anyone who's willing to put money up on the exchange and allow it to rest there, really. Someone who's not just a pure price taker, as in someone who just goes on the exchange, sees amount of money at a price and takes it. Someone who is willing to put a given amount of money up at a price, even if there's no immediate matching to be done at that price. Invariably, the people who take hold of this most are people with quite a lot of money, because it costs quite a lot of money, or you rather you have need to have hold quite a lot of capital in your account if you want to do a lot of market making across a lot of markets at the same time. And so it lends itself to more the people who are in syndicates, or the independently wealthy, or possibly companies who are employed specifically for it, or indeed the exchanges themselves. There is, of course, plenty of scope for exchanges to market make. And some of them do it under their own guise, and other people use sort of firewalled third-party kind of thing, you know, either subdivisions of themselves or another company providing a wide range of liquidity across the exchange and various different markets. So, yeah, they are absolutely vital to the survival of an exchange and for it to grow. Then you have punters, people who just take a price. They're not looking to do anything with their position beyond ride it out until the end. These are useful for market makers, and they're useful for, well, they're useful. All of these four categories are useful to everyone because they're all providing liquidity in a sense, in that market makers do need to get matched at the offers they put up. And punters are people who can do it. But they don't contribute, I would say, exponentially to the volume. So it's nice if a market maker can put up money week in, week out, and know that people will bet it. And that will encourage the market maker to do even more market making. And so in that regard, if someone is a punter and they come back week after week, they will bet and you know, give added impetus to the market maker to make that market. However, it doesn't work in both directions. So empty boxes, punter comes along, doesn't see anything, does it enough times, withdraws his money, doesn't do anything. So, you know, he is sort of one-sided in terms of his liquidity provision and will not drive liquidity rapidly in one direction. Traders, these are people who ideally do not see their position ride out to the end. they will go in and out to either take profit or cut their losses by backing and laying, and potentially will have multiple trades within a given event to either improve their position over the length of it or, you know, open and close, open and close. Traders are not quite as one-sided as punters, because quite often traders will put up, will price take and then put up a resting order. So quite often they'll bet something at one price and decide that they're happy to back it, but they'll lay it later. So providing that lay gets put in as a resting order, they contribute in that regard. The problem being, of course, is that do it for any length of time, and you know this mentality sets in that they would rather just take the price when they're watching it and trade it out of it manually, because of course, if you know you're putting up resting orders, there's always that sense that if you haven't called it particularly right where your exit point should be, you know, a goal can go in and it flies. Or you can get close to a goal and you get matched, and then the goal comes and the market reforms well away. You could have taken more profit. You feel like, you know, you haven't done the trade as well as you could. So some people do, you know, set and forget, as the phrase often is. You know, we'll put a back in or a lay in and then put the reverse side of the trade into rest, which is beneficial to the exchange as a whole. But more and more people, especially with the increase of software over the years, the sort of the trading software, more and more people just go in and out manually at the click of a button, or will go in and out with a bot rather than leave resting orders, which is unfortunate. It's a lot of financial trading is reliant on resting orders for entry. And in fact, you know, limit the phrase, just only ever use limit orders in financial trading, you know, where possible. Is prevalent, and you know, a limit order always has to rest on the exchange, and so even if it's only for a microsecond, you know, it'll rest there. For limit orders, you can read more about financial trading and the difference between a limit order or a market order, but basically limit order says I want to be done at this price and no worse, whereas market order, you send an order to market and whatever you sent, whatever was on your screen when you sent, will not necessarily be what you get when it hits the exchange order book and the price is moving incredibly fast. So limit order guarantees your entry price or your exit price. And limit orders is very much the standard way of trading if you're sensible in finance. But people do not really use those sort of resting style orders. And particularly it's because the nature of sports, there are often seismic events that cause large jumps in the pricing. And we don't even allow the exchange to trade through those points to sort of narrow the jump. You know, there'll be a suspension on the exchange and the prices will often jump significantly before and after the suspension. So that can leave people thinking, you know, oh, I feel like I've missed out on getting out of the trade, a better opportunity had I known, you know, where to put my exit trade, so to speak. If I knew better where the market would go after, say, a goal or a wicket or a six is hit or whatever it may be. So traders now are basically more multiple price takers. So they're not as brilliant as could be in terms of driving up long-term trading volumes. And quite often, they can be ones who will feed off each other almost. They sort of they fulfill the oscillation of odds between one price and another price. Can often be just lots of traders matching off against each other. But yes, I mean, I will say that, you know, more and more financial trading education does preach the use of what is effectively, I suppose, a limit order in the exchange, as in you put in, you don't just go on the back, you sit on the lay side, or you sit on the back side waiting to get matched, and use an order that way. That is ideally much better, but there are other people out there who will be trading just simply with a take price and then get out of price. But you know, the horse racing trading education guys pre horse race very much preach the sitting on the back of the lay side, and that kind of trading does improve liquidity effectively, because while they're sat there waiting to get it matched, market makers or punters or match bettors and arbitrageurs, they can all take advantage of that. So they're a bit better in terms of long-term longevity of an exchange than just straight punters. And then match betting and arbitrage punters who use the exchange, they are weirdly providing the least and the most to the exchange all at once. So effectively, people who will back something at a bookmaker and then lay it back on the exchange, it feels like they're price taker, and you know, they're not particularly contributing much to the sort of general liquidity pool of an exchange. However, they are vital in that market makers invariably don't make their money just out of large scale market makers don't just make their money out of laying even books, even sided books, you know, locking in profits, much like bookmakers. That invariably is actually not the most efficient way to make money. And in fact, what they are doing is they're utterly reliant on people who do match betting and arbitrage to basically facilitate them betting what they consider to be out of line prices at bookmakers. So if they think that a horse should be shorter than is available than the general marketplace, they can market make the back and the lay lower than what's available with the conventional bookmakers. And providing there are people out there who are still interested in doing match betting and arbitrage, which there are, they know that they can that someone will back that horse to the bookmaker, lay it with them, and effectively they now hold a position on that horse. And if they have a true price or a sense of what the actual price should be, then, and it proves accurate over time, over the course of lots of different horses, lots of different markets, whatever it may be, then this works very well for them, because they effectively have an army of agents, if you like, the match bettors and arbitrageurs all getting them on the things they want to get on at not quite the price they'd like to be on, obviously, because they're not placing the bets directly with the bookmakers. But the general consensus is that because bookmakers are putting up trading prices, not true prices, as is correct for them to make the most money out of the 97% or so of their betting population who are long-term losers, that they don't need to, you know, they can still undercut those prices and use the sort of the third party and the match better or the arbitrager to get them on, and there's still money to be made. That is the sort of amount of either skew there is due to recreational money, or alternatively, you can say the skew due to lack of knowledge as to what the true price is at the recreational bookmaker. It's very hard to understand which is which a lot of the time, because quite often people in bookmakers are perfectly aware of what the true price probably is, and aware that the trading price in certain instances is a long way from the true price, but they'll make more money by sticking to the trading price or as close to it, barring arbitrage. But of course, when you're trying to sit on the cusp of arbitrage, you routinely open the door to arbitrage opportunities. So market makers who want to build advantageous positions desperately need these people in order to make it happen. So yes, they are match the sort of the uptake in match betting and arbitrage very much will determine the health of betting exchanges as well. I would argue that match betting and arbitrage has, while you'll look around and you see it absolutely everywhere, I think there's maybe more people, potentially more people doing it than there were, and all of them making less money than you used to be able to. Bookmaking industry is obviously pretty alive and aware to arbitrage and how it all works, and they're desperately trying to stop clients who are going to be just permanently negative EV for them in arbitrage clients from betting with them. I'm sure there's some, as a side note, I'm sure there's people out there going, oh, but they could be positive EV to the bookmaker if they were better at trading. So it's like, no, that's absolutely not the point. The point is that they have to look at their book holistic, you know, overall. And if you go to extra length to beat one small segment of the market, you hemorrhage a load of money and EV out of the larger percentage of your market. You do not slit your own throat in one area, you know, and, you know, just to try and get one over on the other. You know, so that does not quite work like that. So as long as bookmakers do their jobs correctly and target the large percentage of their business that makes them the most money, and as long as people are willing to keep on trying to circumvent the KYC and, you know, get accounts opened and get their friends opened and their dads open and their sons open or wives, daughters, whatever it may be, as long as there is that churn and people building software to track the market better than most, then we'll have match bettors and arbitragers. And as long as they're there and able to get on any sort of decent amount of money collectively as a group, then there should be market makers who are willing to exploit that on exchanges. And it's just the same mechanics as Pinnacle. You know, Pinnacle effectively wants to use its own sharper true prices to trade against the world market, the world recreational market, and its agents in that regard are the people who use arbitrage, which facilitates the transaction of EV, if you like, between one party and the other. So those are the four main areas. Exchanges probably need them all, but they need probably some more than others. in terms of betting exchange users, those who want to be market makers, they need exchanges. Those who want to be punters, they don't really need exchanges necessarily, up until the point where maybe they're restricted or can't get on. And traders, ideally, they do need exchanges, and the match bettors and arbitragers will benefit from exchanges as well. The one slightly sad hit to liquidity is that traders, one of the great appeals of the exchanges when they first came, as far as I was concerned, is they tried to sell the idea of you could, you know, choose your bet and choose your odds and all the rest of it. One of the great appeals was, to me, was that you could back something and you could get out of it. Well, when I say appeals to me, it didn't appeal to me so much, but I could see where the appeal was for people who time and time again, you know, felt like they had, you know, they almost won, were beaten by the last minute goal or whatever. If only I'd been able to trade out before then, lock in some of my profit, how wonderful would that be? And there was this time where, you know, the exchanges had, you know, I'll ignore spread betting, you know, exchanges had the sort of the monopoly on this ability. And I genuinely think that that was something that would appeal recreationally, you know, had Betfair even facilitated a green up button or take profit button or remove risk from one side button or all those buttons. You know, if Betfair pushed cash out feature as a way for people to, you know, and they, you know, the science with all the software was allowing people to do this and doing it for you automatically. And so I think if Betfair had been more aggressive at making it clear that, you know, people talked about exchanges being better prices, but, you know, this they sort of were coming along in the same era as the explosion of Odds Checker and the other odds comparison sites. And so better prices, well, after you had 5% commission put in place, wasn't necessarily better prices compared to if you could open any bookmaker on Odds Checker. So that was a hard sell to just the general recreational person. The idea of being bookmaker, well, that means you've got to basically put something up and leave it potentially. And by and large, people hate leaving things unsupervised online as a rule, and particularly anything money related. So I think that was a potentially hard sell. But I think the idea of taking profit early or reducing the amount you lost. Not that anyone really cares about that, or at least in the recreational side. You know, that really was something that was an opportunity. And of course, bookmakers put cash out in. And of course, all the educated people will be going, oh, but cash out is the biggest ripoff ever, and the margin built into it is ridiculous, all the rest of it. It is, but the idea is what really mattered. The idea was that I could take some money instead of not getting any money at all. And they just took that and squeezed it to the point where they could get the most margin out of it. Again, it's what they're paid to do, it's what they should be doing. And it turns out that, yes, you could have put in, plenty of money. You could have put plenty of margin into it and people would still use it. How could this have been, how could this knowledge been exploited by the exchange? To be honest, if I was the exchange, I would, just have a deep set market maker for cash out purposes. And what I mean by that is, if on any given football match on the three-way odds, someone had a bet and they wanted to, they hit your button that you had allocated cash out. Well, you as the exchange would just always have something available there liquidity-wise. It doesn't matter so much for football matches because there's often a lot of money in running anyway. So cashing out is not so bad. But I think that, As a market maker, people who have pre-match bets on, say, a rugby match, and then there's no liquidity in running for rugby, well, all you needed is some sort of simplistic model that would bet rugby to 80% one side, 120% the other side, something where you feel like even then, you'd really be hard to lose money, and basically would facilitate cashing out for people. So they'd look at it and they'd be like, well, I don't really fancy trading at, 120 backside one, for a three runner market. However, three tries up, someone might go, oh, I will cash out. Or what's my cash out offer? And at that point, it transpires they wouldn't have cared that it had been 120 to 80 that they were betting into for the cash out, because it's been proven that people will take even worse than that and much worse than that with the cash out functions in bookmakers. So, but I think that cash out now is so prevalent, every bookmaker's got it, that effectively killed a lot of the most simplistic base appeal of some of the exchanges, which is very sad. So let's get on more to the question in hand, which let's look at the four bookmakers. Betfair, top of the pile. With regards to what the exchange provider needs. Betfair had it all. They had a very enthusiastic startup management team, people who really believed in the product and wanted to make a success of it. Sadly, they have lost that now. The arrival of the Betfair bookmaker gave a hit to the exchange, and then the buyout by Paddy, or the merger between Paddy Power and Betfair, caused a further big hit. As I said, the exchange needs people behind it who believe in it and are passionate about it. Do not think that Betfair has that behind it now. There is active cost cutting going on, recent transition of a lot of operations to Romania, for example. Cost cutting in and of itself is not a bad thing, particularly if it allows you to give, the savings you make there allowed you to do other, they paid for other exercises to improve liquidity or turnover. If it was just a reallocation of efforts, that's one thing. But it doesn't feel like that. It feels like Betfair's just trying to accept that it's going to make the same amount of money year in, year out, as long as they can from this product, and increase the margin just by reducing the cost on it rather than really try to drive volumes. So Betfair is losing one of the things that I think exchange needs. Punters, I think punters are desperately drying up on the exchange. Traders, I think the initial gold rush has dried off a little bit. There are still people day in, day out who want to become Betfair traders. The allure of working for oneself is pretty powerful, and the idea of doing it while watching sports, etc., and playing, an attractive video game essentially for a living, if it's sometimes an incredibly boring one, still, you know, it has appeal. But I think the amount of time that people are willing to give trading on Betfair, give a spin, maybe that has decreased slightly. I think there were some people who sort of gave it quite a go for a while. And now I think there are more people who get chewed up by it faster. That's purely speculation by me. I can't say I've seen any figures to back that up. But it feels like the traders, you know, their volume's probably held about. Match betting and arbitrage Betfair. This has a little bit, I would suggest, drying. Well, it's been reduced. And consequently, the market maker volume, who is dependent on, to a degree, the match bettors and the arbitragers, will also have taken a hit. And the reason they've taken the hit is because the match better and arbitrage, who, you know, need to maximize their returns as much from everything they do, will have been wooed to other exchanges with lower commission rates. Now, admittedly, match bettors and arbitragers will mostly be losing money on the exchange, making money at the bookmaker. So new deposits at Pinnacle and the exchanges, and withdrawing money from the recreational bookmakers. Still, all the same, it makes sense that you're winning lays, you pay less commission than you would do normally. So the other exchanges have gained liquidity very easily simply by offering a lower commission level, which instantly is, if you've integrated, made sure that your exchange is integrated into all the match betting software websites, odds comparison websites, et cetera, will facilitate liquidity to you. And not only are you getting the liquidity, but if you get the match betting and arbitrage liquidity, and you have a reasonable knowledge of where the true price is, and you'll happen to be the market maker of the exchange, is the exchange itself, then effectively you've got a trading department, effectively, who's making money off the back of whatever your, you know, copyings work. And that is what it is. You know, people at the other exchanges, if they copy Betfair's horse racing market, but offer reduced commission, they effectively steal the match betting and arbitrage business from the exchange with the higher commission, in this case Betfair. Now you've got market makers already being squeezed, often paying premium charge, and now also other exchanges are undercutting Betfair, so they're giving away which horse should be shorter than another horse information, but not getting on because the arbors aren't matching against them there. They're matching over its markets at 2% or whatever. So this means that, you know, exchanges that trade their own markets or have market makers who want to trade their markets for them will have an advantage. And I think this is partly why some of the markets are losing liquidity on Betfair, is because that sort of match betting arbitrage transactional process is less viable when they've got to pay. And, you know, a lot of the people who join match betting and arbitrage, you know, their first foray, you know, they'll open up recreational accounts, having seen some clickbait kind of thing on how to make money betting or whatever, never lose at betting again or whatever. You know, they'll open up an exchange account straight off, and they'll open up, you know, their Bet365 or whatever account straight off. And then they'll log into whatever match betting service, and the match betting service will calculate, you know, where's the best place to lay off their bet after they've backed it. And, you know, if it if correctly calculates the commission, etc., well, it's every chance they should be laying off at BetDAC or Smarkets or Matchbook rather than laying off at Betfair. And so consequently, they get advantage of those layback bets. So that is undoubtedly a problem. So Betfair's, you know, losing liquidity through lack of appetite, interest of the people. They don't want to rebate the, the big market makers compensate for the fact that they're charging very high commission relative to the rest. They don't want to offer reduced commission actively very much, it seems, to people market making in markets with no liquidity. You know, for me, if there's a terrible market that has no volume, if you want to market make in it, not only would you pay zero commission, you'd pay zero premium charge on it, on that particular sector. And also, I probably would rebate you some of the profits. If it's just empty boxes week in, week out, back and layside, I don't see why they shouldn't just go to extra, because you're making, you know, 5% of nothing. And, you know, you could be making 2% of something. So it just makes no sense to me not to actively encourage, where possible, the increased market making. And you can see people who have made, someone who has made an effort in this regards in a weird way is Pinnacle. Is Pinnacle used to price up very limited stuff, but they've slowly but surely expanded their product offering. A good example is, if anyone's, you know, seen this, is huge amount of biathlon head-to-heads. Is there a biathlon genius trader in Curaçao right now? Maybe. There may be. But what's equally likely is that someone just knows that there is basically people who know a lot about it out there, and it's probably not the people working at the bookmakers. So they just put up their odds, and they can put up their odds exactly the same as Bet365. And they know that the guy who can't get on at Bet365 will come to you because he can get on with you, and you're betting it to a pretty keen percentage as well. So it's pretty attractive for him. You're basically offering Bet365 price, but a little bit better. And he'll hit you, and this will go on for a few weeks. It'll become apparent who's the guy who really is brilliant at biathlon head-to-heads. And pretty soon, you are moving your head-to-heads off his bet, you know, 10%. Getting all the arbors on the other side, because you've gone and actively made sure to get your biathlon prices on every bloody, you know, arb alert system or match betting alert system or wherever you can. And so now you can begin to monetize that sharp business. You know, with market making, you need to encourage people to step out their comfort zone on the exchanges and try market making, something they haven't done before. And you need to make sure there is a bit of a cushion there for them in the forms of rebates or reduced commissions or whatever. And then they may find themselves in a situation where, you know, they'll profile the market when the smart money comes in, how much people like to bet on it, what size the market's good in. And, you know, these things can evolve. And I think, you know, that's I'm slightly disappointed that some of the market makers haven't made more efforts, but obviously they may be dedicated to horse racing or in running, you know, football, whatever they may do. And they may not want to step out of that. You know, they've got a good thing going. It's pretty much automated after all these years of doing it on Betfair. But yeah, so Betfair's suffering in that regard. And yeah, they don't help themselves by not changing the commission structure, and the premium charge is a problem also. I would say that the premium charge did sort of, they were trying to tackle a problem, which probably was a problem, but did it, in my view, the wrong way. There were people who were just farming the potential new punters and traders out there for cash with very minimal risk taken on. And those punters and traders, or rather the traders particularly, who probably would have been a good target new recreational market for Betfair, were probably getting carted out faster than was necessary. And consequently, you know, you had to prevent that drain of new organic accounts opening, because it was getting a bit too hard to beat Betfair with people with faster, you know, court siding. You know, court siders was a big trigger, I think, ultimately, for the premium charge coming in for those people who ran the court sider based syndicates. So I did think something needed to be done, but I don't think the right solution was to just say, look, you're doing something that isn't good for the ecosystem, but we'll just take more money off you and allow you to keep doing it. There should have been something put in place really to target the kind of behavior. You know, if people were just beating the market hands down, doing something that felt very fair to the ecosystem, great. Now, I know this does feel a bit like too much interference, but if there was something that really is just causing, you know, damage to the potential new liquidity to the exchange, you've got to look at the health of the whole ecosystem overall. And so I think they should have done something, but I don't think the premium charge was the optimal way to do it. And obviously it has damaged aspirations of market makers having to pay premium charge. If you've, you know, got to that scale. There's also no really advanced, they Betfair have not evolved to get sort of some sort of advanced form of credit or risk distribution for credit. So, you know, if I'm market making the correct score and the three-way, you know, if I've laid the away team to win 2-1 and I've laid the home team, well, both bets can't win. And, you know, in certain, you know, there should be a degree of correlation built in for all markets on all sports that allows you to basically use some of your credit internally for markets due to the fact that quite often you'll be in positions which, you know, can't all lose correctly. Now, there's certain areas where Betfair is sort of better at this than others. You know, just things like, you know, cross-matching obviously was a big difference, you know, when in two-way markets. But markets understanding each other across sort of gaps and how the risks are related to each other or contingent upon each other, that would be some way that they could improve. You know, you wouldn't have to have quite so much money in your Betfair bank, you know, Betfair account in order to put up all the backs and lays and things that are necessary to make a market properly. And Betfair never also put together any sort of decent software. You know, they had a good API, but I think there was definitely an opportunity for Betfair to create some sort of market making, very simplistic software tool that could be given even to bookmakers. You could even take it to a bookmaker and say, look, you just type the percentage for each outcome in here, say what percentage book you want to bet it to, and it's going to throw those things up on the exchange. You know, this kind of stuff could have been done with the right appetite. To allow, you know, all sorts of different people to have a go at market making. But they haven't. So there you go. And I don't think there's any interest to do it now anyway. BetDAC, very confused as to what BetDAC strategy, if strategy even exists there, what it is. There seems now, you know, God, they've got a TV advert. You know, there seems to be now renewed interest in it. I imagine it depends on who's in what role at Ladbrokes Coral at any given time as to how much interest there is in it. And it could change at any time dependent on who's in charge of it. I don't know what their long-term strategy is for it. For the screenshotters out there on Twitter, I have seen what appears to be quite large trades placed on BetDAC. And that's certainly different to, you know, one period where you just couldn't find any money at all on BetDAC. I don't know how much market making for it was done via just direct sort of API style copying from Betfair historically or now. I think historically quite a lot. And how much is just extra margin tacked on the prices that were made at Ladbrokes or the prices that were made at Coral now. You know, it's hard for me to say who's doing the market making there or what systems they're using for it. But there does seem to be some interest in it, like I say, because certainly for some of the bigger matches and so on. I'm assuming that the bigger liquidity things that happen on BetDAC is some of the Betfair market makers who are being a bit more proactive. The bigger bet, you know, have decided that, you know, they can just send the same streams they're sending to Betfair's API to BetDAX and, you know, give it a go there. Why there's not more of the market makers in Betfair doing that, not so sure. Harking back many years ago, when IG Sports existed, when I worked there in spread betting, they were market making into Betfair and BetDAC using their models. It was great business for all concerned. We market made certain things that would just had no money at all, things like rugby on Betfair. And Betfair, while pretty tight, I'll give an example. the IG account opened at 5% commission. Pretty large spread betting company back then, Finance. You know, now they're a huge company, but still pretty large company back then, and they made them open up just the same kind of account that you and I would open up now. 5%. Got it down to about 2% in a matter of days, I think. Obviously, with the amount of money that we were turning over. But it still makes me laugh that there was no, like, sit-down meeting where they said, oh, you know, you're going to be doing this seriously. We've got a special product for you. But they did, at least back then, provide heavily reduced commission rates for markets that had very little liquidity. At least a step in the right direction. They used to do that for Betfair and BetDAC. And it wasn't particularly, you know, there was no difference between doing it for BetDAC to Betfair. And I don't see why BetDAC doesn't get more of what is very obviously the Betfair market makers doing it. But there you go. Again, you know, putting up all these offers on Betfair, need a lot of money in there to then have a load of money in BetDAC. You know, again, if I was BetDAC and I had a market maker come to me who said they'd be market making on Betfair, want to do it on BetDAC, here's my statement. You can see I've made 50 million the last, you know, 10 years, whatever, market making on Betfair. I'm pretty good for this. Can you give me credit so I don't have to deposit a load of money with you? It's definitely something I'd be interested in if I'm BetDAC. I maybe may try to do some sort of credit arrangement or, you know, some leverage, give you double credit for, you know, existing deposits, something like that. Again, people just don't seem to want to get that creative with driving this stuff. Smarkets were, I think, the people who sort of really pushed the internal trade, you know, those reports Company House, you know, about how their internal trading division works. It's where they make a huge chunk of their money from the exchange. Again, this is poaching a lot of good match betting and arbitrage money from Betfair with their lower commission. And also, I'm sure they've employed some smart people, quantitative analysts, developers, that kind of thing, to come up with, you know, better ways of trading things algorithmically. But they also have the benefit of, as long as Betfair's got any sort of liquidity, there's a great tissue for you to start from. So yeah, you know, and they now seem to want to go the bookmaking route. It seems that Jonathan Trost seems to have at least global ambitions for the exchange, which is a good thing. But seems to now become a bit sort of divided his attention by this new Smarkets bookmaker. I don't know if he just sees that as being a more efficient way to basically do what he already does on the Smarkets exchange, but I'm not so sure. I definitely think that Smarkets has got greater potential rival to Betfair. They don't have any good software tied into it. So the traders, at least I don't think they do. So the traders that they need, their market makers, don't know how much interest they've got in having market makers that aren't themselves. Punters, I think they've probably got a few of those, and they've definitely got some of the match betting and arbitrage business. If you're targeting the match betting arbitrage and punters, then to have a bookmaker that is effectively sort of smart, I suppose, tackles those in the correct way, then maybe that's a good enough reason to sort of switch more to the bookmaker model. I don't know, really. But yeah, I just don't know whether they're going to take over from Betfair or not. Matchbook are doing a sort of hybrid, I suppose, in that I think that there are, you know, I think Matchbook can make efforts to seek out people to make their markets if possible, but also doing a lot of market making themselves internally, one way or another. And they, of course, have employed the different commission structure. I think some of the more recreational exchange users just can't get their head around or like the idea of paying 1% on all trades, even the losing ones, having grown up in the Betfair system. So it's hard for me to know how well the recreational business will move over to them. They must be getting some of the match betting arbitrage business, And I think they definitely get some of the punter business, you know, particularly if you are not a trader, you're not paying that 1% again and again and again. You know, if you're only paying it, you know, when you have one straight up bet. So they're definitely going to be driving some of that kind of traffic to the exchange. And market makers, I think, because of the tie-in with the syndicates, so Matthew Benham's sharing it, and his syndicate background, there will be good people to make markets. And I think they'll also be in contact with other people who are keen to make markets on their behalf. So I like Matchbook's promise as a perspective exchange, but I don't know if it'll be an exchange in the way that Betfair's an exchange. You know, they do have the software hooked up to Matchbook now. You know, some of the trading sort of, I think BetAngel maybe has a Matchbook. I think Geek's Toy does have a Matchbook. But again, with traders, you know, they're thinking about, oh, do I want to be paying 1% in and out every time? I mean, I think that the 1%, you know, the financial exchange style cost system is probably the best long term. And I think it would be good for the exchange to move towards that. But it's a case of if everyone's on that scale, then you'll drive commission rates down, and different people do need to be on different commission rates basis on how much they provide to the betting exchange ecosystems. So, yeah, I can definitely see Matchbook rivaling a portion of Betfair's business. I can see Smarkets attracting a portion of Betfair's business, and BetDAC, you know, if it wanted to again. But I don't see any of them looking to appeal to all those four pillars of sort of exchange liquidity in equal measure. And I don't see anyone other than just really simplistic reducing commission rate making any effort to really pull that money away. You know, I think partly there is this potential conflict of interest in that it's possible that Matchbook wants to do most of the market making itself, and Smarkets definitely seem to want to do almost all of it. And so if you're not going to allow people into that party, you know, they're looking to attract people from the other three categories, and those people will be attracted in as much as, you know, the one market maker at Smarkets, you know, potentially can facilitate them. And you really, the great thing about Betfair is that, you know, you should have all sorts of different people market making all sorts of different areas, providing a more wider range of markets for people to trade. So, yeah, I'm not. Can it retain its position as number one? Yes. I think it could absolutely decimate everyone if they wanted to. I think there's, you know, they could put a few things in place which would revitalize the exchange pretty quickly. It would run probably at a lower margin and lower return overall for, you know, a short period, and then volumes would come up and it would just improve dramatically. So I think Betfair can retain its position if it wants to. If it doesn't, then I don't know to what extent BetDAC, Smarkets, and Matchbook would replace it in a like-for-like way, but certainly they would probably survive in some form or another. And certainly if there was no other, you know, if Betfair gave it up, they'd attract money just by the fallout. So, right, I'm now going to look at just a little bit on the financial markets and how they relate to betting exchanges. And then I'm also going to look at the impact of the US and potentially blockchain betting exchanges. So, yes, looking at betting exchanges from the perspective of financial markets, it's funny because a lot of people who don't have experience of financial trading or financial markets often will think that everything's traded on one exchange in general. But just to give you some perspective of London traded stocks, or other stocks, let's say you took the FTSE 100 stocks, they'll be listed on the London Stock Exchange, and everyone thinks that that is the only place they'll be listed. But in fact, this isn't true. And if you disregard those people, you know, the foreign listings, you know, you have exchange operators, BATS, Chi-X, Turquoise, NASDAQ Europe. You know, there's a variety of different, you know, so Shell can be listed, listed on the London Stock Exchange, but then it will be traded on a variety of different exchanges. And all these exchanges will have tried to find their own little niche, either trying to provide some liquidity narrower than the existing market, or potentially providing greater depth behind the front of the book for people who want to place bigger trades but pay a bit more spread. Or they may just be competing on costs. But they all form sort of part of this ecosystem. And invariably, the trading products they use, part of the thing that benefits these exchanges is that, you know, if you use a stock trading piece of software like Fidessa, for example, they'll have all those exchanges fed into the software. So it's like having a Geek's Toy or Bet Angel, which has Betfair, BetDAX, Markets, and Matchbook all in one place. I do think there should be a product like that. I do think that if that product was presented nicely and a bit more sort of modern app, bubbly style friendly than, say, some of the software that is out there. I mean, that's not a critique. You know, those softwares are designed to be functional, not hugely aesthetic or necessarily even hugely user-friendly at times, certainly with settings and configurations. They're designed to do a job. But I think there's definitely room for someone out there to put all those four exchanges into one platform, make it very easy, you know, and you could have, you know, make sure that whoever is the best price after commissions, you know, from each of your accounts is put, you know, factored in. And even better be as if it could pool your credit so that effectively you could deposit it at one outlet and it would collectively act as your bank for all the exchanges. So you could be backing on Betfair, laying back on Matchbook, and it would all collect in one location, which, you know, something that all the financial trading people are allowed to do. So I think that is something which really could be beneficial if it was inherited from the financial sector. I would say that, like, looking at recent studies, the increasing in exchanges does not mean, you know, disproportionate increase in volumes traded. Stock trading volume has gone up, sort of particularly on say the London Stock Exchange, volumes have gone up, but it's, you know, volumes have not gone up because of extra exchanges. It's sort of become, the volume has grown, but grown because of increased participation as a whole by people buying and selling shares, as opposed to the fact that new exchanges come along, making it more attractive suddenly to trade financially. And again, in the case of the sports betting exchanges, I think the new exchanges are not bringing new people to the betting exchange party. They're just dividing up the existing pie more and more. There may be some exceptions. There may be a bit of growth out there because of it. But that's not the trend in other industries or other areas. So it's one of those things where consolidation or perceived consolidation, in that everything funnels into one place, actually is beneficial. It's nice to have competition because it keeps costs and commissions down. But it's not good to divide your liquidity at all, if possible. And that is definitely something that is happening. So that's a little sort of from the perspective of, you know, how financial markets have not needed to overcome that same barrier, I suppose, because everything feeds into the same software. You can trade easily with the same companies, sorry, with different exchanges all through one one product, one account. And that's something that would hopefully benefit, if it was ever to happen, the betting exchanges. From the US perspective, there seems to be, it's bizarre seeing the US market exposed to so many different betting ideas all at once that they hadn't really bothered to take any interest in outside of their sort of bubble for so long. But it does seem that betting exchanges are suddenly seen in the matter of weeks that, you know, the first sort of set of legalization of states has outside of Nevada and so on has come on, that already people are attaching, and it seems much faster than I would have thought, attaching onto the idea of an exchange. And not just sharp bettors who are the kind of people who see the benefit of an exchange as a way of getting money down, but it seems that the idea is appealing to even some of the more recreational US bettors. I find this interesting, and I think there's a possible element to a small degree behind it in that Wall Street and financial trading is kind of really wired into the American psyche. You know, business news in America can be in the main news. It's not put away in a little business section somewhere else. You know, the activity of the S&P 500 and so on, that's reported as part of the main news often. And if you look at the way the sort of the savings plans, the 401k in America often works, is that often the most simplistic version is just an S&P 500 tracker index that you invest in. And then slowly, when you get older, this gets moved into US government bonds. But this consequently gives a much better people. You know, there are plenty of people out there who just could not tell you whether you're, you know, you ask at the end of the year, is your pension up or down, or even what it's invested in. But because quite often it's invested just in this one simple product, it's not a bad place to have it invested in. But, you know, that creates this sort of element of, the average American is more aware of where the domestic indexes and financial indexes are. And financial trading is, you know, considered a sort of, I don't know if revered profession is quite right, but, you know, it's definitely has cachet. And I think that there is a greater just sort of general all-purpose appeal to the idea of financial style trading. And consequently, they can see the appeal of the betting exchange, and that peer-to-peer model, I think, is very appealing to them. And so, interestingly, the exchange there may have a better time of attracting recreational-style bettors because, you know, for me, part of the exchange, it should be both, it should also be a fun product, an entertainment product in the same way that, you know, bookmakers, you know, betting with a bookmaker is supposed to be a fun, entertainment product in that, the idea that you can sit down and watch a game and trade it rather than just have one bet just before kickoff and wait till the end of the match. The idea of trading, it should be sort of quite an enjoyable exercise, you know, in and of itself. And so if you can get people who do trading for the fun of it, not just because they desperately want to quit their jobs to become professional traders or because they're arbing or because, you know, they're a massive syndicate market making, whatever. If you get those people who actually want to do trading for fun and, you know, don't necessarily aspire to make fortunes from it, hope not to lose too much from it as a hobby. I think there could be more hobbyist traders in America potentially than people maybe initially think. And I think it's because of that mindset that's already there. So I think that the US would be a potentially great market still, I hope, for an exchange. And what I also found interesting was it's tricky in that so much of American betting is done on the spread. So let's say the spread is -7 for the Patriots and it goes in running and, you know, they score a field goal and it goes to, say, you know, field goal on the first drive, I don't know, goes to -10, whatever. You know, if you've placed a bet on the -7, and you want to now trade out, it requires someone to market make something away from parity, so away from sort of 10 to 11 both sides, on the -7 so that you can trade out of it. Or alternatively, you can take a trade on the +10, create a, you know, sort of a middle. But if you want to cash out that existing bet, take the profit, not, you know, not necessarily have to play around with the middle or whatever. It just, there's a certain amount of market making difficulty when you're doing everything on handicaps. You know, an example, I remember trading rugby many years ago, and Betfair would put up three handicaps, and they put it up several days before the match. So sometimes that mainline handicap would, you know, they put up a handicap of, you know, minus five, it would go off at minus eight. So your supposedly parity handicap, you know, would already be miles sort of away from parity. And then they keep you those three handicaps for the entire course of the match. So, you know, if three tries were scored in the first 30 minutes, quite often you could bust all three handicaps. They could all be trading sort of 110, 101, you know, one side, all of them. That made for a really unappealing market. And so they've got to get the in-running handicap system and pre-match handicap system really right for market makers for a US betting exchange. And I even thought an old idea, quite cutely, an idea was originally tried by Cantor. Cantor Spread Fair was. I say this is quite funny because the spin-off Cantor Gaming in Vegas from Cantor Fitzgerald provides the sports books for eight casinos in Vegas, and this is one of the largest providers of sports books odds in Las Vegas. And what's amusing is that they had a product many years ago, the UK spread betting, sports spread betting side of Cantor, had a product called Spreadfair, which was a spread betting exchange. And I, so it's peer-to-peer spread betting. And I wonder if that idea could potentially work in America. So that Patriots spread, you know, it could be 6.98 to 7.02. And people could be buying and selling at that. And, you know, then you could trade it like that. And, you know, if you put it on a ladder, so it looked very much like the financial trading markets, and allowed people to buy and sell, you know, totals and handicap spreads in that spread fashion. I think that'd be potentially quite interesting. The Americans might take to that, you know, very much just a case of these are stocks. So the stock in the question is total points. The stock in question is spreads. Buy it or sell it in the same way you buy or sell Apple or Google. I think, weirdly, they could not only get spread betting quickly, but they could get spread betting and exchanges quickly or at the same time. Possibly not. I may have really stretched this. But I do sort of like that idea. But yeah, so I have high hopes if an exchange ever came to the US for it to be popular. And then the final subject is blockchain, just because I think people probably would ask me about this on anything on exchanges. You know, the aspect of blockchain, triple entry bookkeeping, I suppose, if you want to go back to 1989, so Yuji Ujiri's original concepts on triple entry bookkeeping, which then blockchain made so much more accessible, is the idea of, you know, sort of enforced integrity in any transaction with the third observer, except in blockchain, it's everyone is an observer within the blockchain. How does this improve upon exchanges? How does this improve the four pillars? How does it get more liquidity in? You know, if people trust an exchange that uses blockchain technology more and are more willing to use it, fine. If it doesn't have any impact in that regard, then I think it's one of these things, everyone's looking to add blockchain to everything. We've had an exchange that worked very well. There are things that we could do to make that exchange better again. And I don't think it necessarily requires blockchaining it in order to make it be revived. For me, and the same with cryptocurrency, you know, yeah, facilitate whatever exchange, as long as everyone's trading the currency they want to see on the screen. You know, sure, get Ethereum, get Bitcoin in, but get fiat currencies in as well. You know, for me, everyone's like, oh, I want a cryptocurrency bookmaker. And it's because, like, it keeps overheads down. You can do it much more cheaply. Great. Fine. But for me, proper exchange should, you know, everyone should be able to trade in whatever currency they want, if possible. You could maybe have the withdrawal and deposit costs a lot cheaper for people who want to use, you know, cryptocurrencies, whatever. You can make it advantageous to use crypto, for example, but I wouldn't want an exchange that's dedicated to just one particular type of currency. And yeah, as to whether, you know, added blockchain, I know there's a project for sort of a blockchain-based exchanges, and people sort of tweet stuff at me and say, you know, look at this. And yeah, it, you know, if people feel that like recording every transaction of the exchange on the blockchain will improve integrity of the exchange, trust of the exchange, and that will drive liquidity, great. But, you know, we've got plenty of financial exchanges around the world doing trillions of dollars of turnover off the blockchain. And, you know, it does okay. So, yeah, I wouldn't get too obsessive about that personally just yet. So there you go. There's quite a lot there. God, nearly 70 minutes or so of my rambling. I hope you all find it enjoyable. And I hope you come back for episode 9.